Thank you, Cliff. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. I am so thrilled to be here with you guys this weekend. I so appreciate and am so grateful for the invitation. And I've traveled a long way to be here, but I don't have any confusion that you need to hear what I have to say tonight. It's just clear I have an overwhelming need to say it. So I'll do about anything. But, you know, I say that in jest sometimes, but the truth is, I think that when we get touched and graced with sobriety, we do have to share it with each other. We'll just kind of burst sometime if we don't share the good news. And I certainly feel that and am grateful for the opportunity tonight. The good news for you is I've only got about a 20-minute story. The bad news is it takes me about an hour and a half to tell it. And but I'll try to end on time or close to that. So thank you for just a wonderful talk. I'm just so pleased that I've known Bob and Sue for a while, but I've never heard her share her story. And I just thought it was terrific, and I leave better off for having heard that. And great to be here with so many other friends. I thank June for the invitation, and Connie, my wife, and I just love June and Mark, and my friends Carl and Michelle here. I appreciate them driving up, and my friend Tyson, who's kind of new to the area and moved from Nashville to the West Lakes area. So, man, if you just keep showing up and staying sober in AA, you just make friends all over the place, and I'm grateful for that. You know, my sobriety date is June 30th, 1989, and my home group is the Recovery on the Road group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we meet on Wednesdays and Saturdays in Nashville on historic Music Row. So if you come to Nashville, come see us. I think that Cliff and his wife are coming soon, and so we look forward to hosting them. You know, I'm going to do what you asked me to do. It's funny, as I listened to Sue kind of talk about that in reference a few times, you know, and our book says in a general way, we share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And for years, I thought I did that, and I've come to realize that's not really accurate in my case. I tell you what I think I was like. Yeah. I tell you my vague memory of what happened. And I'll let Connie tell you what I'm like now. Because the truth is, Connie, we were at a conference a few years ago. I gave a talk. Connie was sitting in the front row right where Pat is with that same judgmental look that Pat's given me. And we got up to the room later. I'd given what many people think was maybe the best talk ever given in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Connie said, you know, that last 10 or 15 minutes of your talk, and I prepared myself for a compliment. I said, yeah, baby. And she said, I would love to meet that guy. She said, I wish you would bring him home sometime. And you know, she was kidding, but there's some truth to that, right? And what I realize is how I see me is not always how other people see me. And how I see you is never the whole story, right? When our book says, with regard to that relationship with a higher power, and it says no one can fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. I would say it is likewise true for me that I can never fully or define or comprehend any other individual. What we have, just like the relationship with a higher power, what we have is a relationship. And we talk, and so what I know about you is how I relate to you. And that's never the whole story. I was going to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina to a conference. This has been 15 or 20 years ago. And I was describing myself to the guy that was going to pick me up. And because we weren't yet, you know, texting pictures and stuff. And we'd never met. And he told me to meet him at baggage carousel number 6. And I landed and I went there. And we couldn't find each other, right? I'm looking for him, and finally I call, and I said, man, I can't find you. And he says, I'm right here where I said I'd be at baggage claim number 6. I said, you can't be. I said, because I'm at baggage claim number 6. And we looked around, and we saw we're the two idiots with our phone looking for each other. And it became immediately clear why we hadn't connected. We had both described ourselves as much more attractive than we really are. So my perception, that disease of perception, how I see things, how I experience things, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, for a good while after, and sometimes today, how I view things is funneled through sometimes the prism of my alcoholism. It is funneled through, and I see through sometimes the fear or the pride or the greed or the envy or whatever those seven deadly sins and all their cousins are, that those things define how I view and see the world. And likewise, when Chuck C. talked about that new pair of glasses, I think that that's kind of my experience of that is what you do for me through the process of these 12 steps and having a spiritual experience and having that psychic change is I begin to see things differently than I saw them. I begin to experience things differently. I don't know that the world is much different than before I sobered up, but my experience of it is remarkably different. I'm married to the same wife. For a lot of my sobriety, I had the same job. I've got the same daughter. I had many of the same friends. But my experience of those people was significantly different. First, after being physically sober, and then continued as I become freer of that bondage of self, I just begin to see the world differently. And that's a real gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to drink for a minute before we get sober again. But my sobriety date, when I taste June 30th of 89, for me, that means the last time I had a drink or a drug was June the 29th of 1989. Sue mentioned that her story included drugs, and I'm like you, so I hate when people use euphemisms. I did drugs, and I'll tell you, I'm an alcoholic, and I got that very special relationship that an alcoholic has with alcohol, and it was a fully committed relationship. But it was not a monogamous relationship. Eh? Yeah. We invited other things to the marital bed. And so just know there was a lot going on. But June the 29th of 1989 is the last time I had a drink or a drug. And so June the 30th is my sobriety date. I was 6 months sober. I went to my sponsor, Frank. And I said, Frank, I'm still confused about this sobriety date. Is that the last day I had a drink or the first day I didn't have one? And he said, Steve, I'm just so impressed with the quality of questions keeping you up at night. He said, I don't care. He said, pick one. Because I'm much less concerned with when you had your last drink than you not taking the next one. And so that's why I took June the 30th, and that's what it's been. But on June the 29th, I was not stopping drinking. I had no intention to go from that night till this without a drink. But I was scheduled to go into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. And scheduled is the term. I had not had some epiphany and decided I needed or wanted to stop drinking. I certainly wasn't looking for a design for living that works in tough going. You know, I wasn't looking for a kit of spiritual tools. I simply wanted to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my sixth DUI a year before. And as a result of a plea bargain agreement, they were giving me jail time, and they were going to cut some of that jail time off if I would go to what they referred to as residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And I'd never heard all those words strung together at one time, and I wasn't sure what it meant, but it sounded marginally better than jail. So I agreed that I would do that, and I had a year of probation to complete this this treatment experience, and I'm into the 13th month of the 12-month grace period that they gave me, and was finally headed off to treatment on July the 1st. And my buddy Ricky was my wife and I went out with three other couples on June the 29th. This wasn't a wild night. We just had dinner. We came home from dinner. And my last drink, as humiliating as this is for me to share with you, was an Amaretto on the rocks. Yeah, I share your disgust. But I had no idea that, I mean, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had something else. And I'll tell you something that's sad. There is no street cred in Amaretta and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, those were the dark days. It's pitiful. But we'd just gone out. We came home. I fixed myself a drink and smoked a joint and went to bed. I got up the next day. We took my daughter Abby out for the day. I'm not going to tell the Chuck E. Cheese story, Carl. But don't go to Chuck E. Cheese on your first day sober. I'll just share that with you, okay? Yeah. Yeah. Because it is loud in there. And you're short and coming at you from every direction. And I said, just as I was gathering my emotional balance in there, I saw a 6-foot mouse. I said to Connie, baby, do you see the mouse? We came home, July the 1st, my buddy Ricky comes by to drive me off to this treatment facility. And my wife Connie walked me out to the car. Connie's last words to me as I was headed off to treatment, I see a lot of my AA brethren kind of tear up at this because they didn't get the kind of support I got from my wife. She said, no matter what, baby, don't stop drinking. She said, I don't know what you're going to be doing over there, but just do your time and come on back home. And I will tell you now, Connie and I we'd been married 7 years at the time. We had met just over 7 years before that. Connie had been working, living in Lake Tahoe, dealing baccarat. She had got married while she was in Lake Tahoe. She got divorced while she was in Lake Tahoe. She came back to Nashville with a divorce pickup truck, a divorce pocket full of money, and a divorce 8-ball of cocaine. I just fell immediately head over heels for her. We started running together a little bit. Two or three months later, we went down to Mexico and drank some tequila out of a coconut, actually, which seems odd. We ended up on a boat that took us out into what they swear were international waters, and an Austrian merchant marine read in Spanish what he swears was a wedding ceremony. We don't speak Spanish, so we're not sure what we agreed to. But we've been arguing about that for 40-plus years now. But what I sometimes forget to get back to, and Connie thinks it's important that I let you know, that her sobriety date is 10 days after mine. Now, I did not talk to her in that 10-day period. She went out with my sister. The story has variances to it, but she was out, ordered a round of drinks. They had that round of drinks. They ordered a second round of drinks. When the waitress is handing her second drink, she said, no, thank you, I've had enough. And she said she didn't have that thought one moment before that. And for years we said we didn't know where that came from, and today we know. But Connie is an active sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsors a lot of women, and I could only hope to be the member of AA that she is, that she quietly is at home in her home group, sponsoring women, doing the stuff that she does while I run around and talk about stuff she's home doing. Well, you didn't, that wasn't a laugh line. That was that's where you're supposed to go, no, Steve, you're fantastic. The first time I took a drink, I was 18 years old. I come from a middle-class family, nothing special going on at home. Nobody's knocking anybody around. I got two older brother, an older sister, a younger sister. My dad had died unexpectedly when he was 47 years old, and I was 18. That is not why I drank, but he wasn't there to be one of the guardrails, maybe, that kind of helped straighten me up. My mom was dealing with her grief, so she was not, she was caught up in what she was doing, and I was a very immature 18-year-old, and I think, like Sue said, that when I took that drink, it was just a magical moment for me, because, see, I didn't understand, both before I got to AA, And after I've been here, I didn't understand that I could have alcoholism even when I wasn't drinking. Now, that night, I don't know if I was an alcoholic just before I took a drink that night, and I don't know if I was alcoholic right after I took that drink, and I don't know at what point I became alcoholic. It's a debate I don't enter into. Because I don't know if I drank alcoholically from that moment on because I drank so enthusiastically. And turns out that I can't prove if I could moderate my drinking because I did not try to moderate. And I don't know whether I could have stopped and not started again because I did not try. And our book says that they thought that many of them could have stopped drinking early in their drinking career, though they have no way of proving it. And they couldn't prove it for the same reason I couldn't. They didn't try. Because what alcohol, why would I not do this again? Now, I began to pay a price right away. I mean, there were consequences from my drinking, but I was more than ready to pay the piper for this. I mean, you know, early on, my drinking, you know, I mean, I had blackouts, so I lost stuff. I love what the comedian Dave Attell says. He said he's a blackout drinker, as he likes to call it, time travel. And that's what it felt like. Right? Like, whoa, how did I get here in the future, and what has been going on? And if you're like me, you don't ask questions to people the next day. I'm kind of like a forensic detective, you know. You're trying to read people's faces. You try to ask innocuous questions. And then you got that one buddy that you call and go, man, tell me, how'd it go last night? Oh, Steve, even you don't want to know, man. It was bad last night. And But man, what it was doing for me, you know, it was talked about. Our book says that alcohol, among other things, is a social lubricant. And man, I get that, right? It is because it's just like oiling up, and then I can move easily amongst you. There's no friction. There's no stop and start. It is just easy. And without that, see, before I got to AA and after I got sober in AA, what I don't realize is that part of that unmanageability, at least I believe, of the first step, part of that spiritual malady that was talked about, part of that selfishness and self-centeredness that's the root of my trouble, part of that hyper-self-consciousness makes me uncomfortable in your presence. But I don't act like a guy that's uncomfortable. I know what it's like to stand in front of a door and steel myself up to get ready sober to walk into a work situation or a family situation or a social situation and walk through that door and act like a guy would act if he were comfortable, if he were confident, if he were outgoing, if he were gregarious. And I know what it's like to walk back out that door later and feel empty inside. And that acting, Bill talks a lot about actors. He uses those parallels in the 12 and 12 quite a bit. In one of the lines, it says, we are like actors in a play who've forgotten our lines. And that's the way I know this looking back. None of this could I have articulated as I'm going through it. But as I'm walking through life thinking, it looked like you know your lines and I am improvising. And I'm trying to guess and I'm trying to see What do I need to say? What do I need to look like? How do I need to sound to work okay in this group? Try to read the room. And it's exhausting. That acting is hard work. Ask an actor. It's hard work. And so it required me to spend a lot of time alone so I could be somehow relaxed. I'm a guy that stayed up really late at night. That 1, 2, 3 in the morning when the rest of the world was asleep is about the only time I felt like that I wasn't not doing something I was supposed to be doing. Because that regular 9-to-5 stuff I wasn't able to show up for. I was working in a family business. I worked with and for my brother and my mother after my dad died. I went into that business at 21 years old and stayed until I was 58 years old. So I'm the uncommon alcoholic who only had one job, which shouldn't be confused with working that job, but I had it. I stayed employed for a long time. But I would get up in the mornings. I lived in a little apartment complex, and my brother knew that, you know, I mean, I just couldn't show up for work. And it wasn't always because, like, I was drunk. I had a sales job, and I couldn't make sales calls. You know, they begin to notice after a while. So I'd get up in the mornings in this little apartment complex and get in my car and move it over two or three apartment buildings and then come back to my apartment. And because I knew my brother would be driving by when he couldn't get me to see if my car was out there. I would go to movies a lot during the day because when I was in that dark theater watching a movie and try to lose myself in it because I couldn't go. When I traveled, I'd go, at the time I was driving through little towns in Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, and Kentucky selling redwood patio furniture. No, I wasn't selling it. I had some to sell. But no sales were completed. But I would literally go in, and again, I laugh at the absurdity of it tonight, but I'm telling you, this was loneliness. This was fear. This was, I would pull up to a place and not be able to go in. And then I would pull up to the next place and not be able to go in. And sometimes I would wait in my car. I was going to little furniture stores, usually at a little town square. You talked about those little towns looking the same, Sue, and those were the towns I was going to. And usually the person that owned the furniture store might also own the funeral home. You know, and it was, these were owner-operated places, and I'd sit out in my car and wait for him or her to leave to go to lunch and then go in and ask for them. And they would say, they're at lunch, and I would tell them I came by. And I had to call my brother at the end of the day. You know, there wasn't email and weren't cell phones. I was supposed to call in and give a call report, talk about what I was doing, and I would just have to either not call or I would call, and his assistant would answer, and Becky, and for years, Becky knew the game, right? And I'd go, Becky, is he there? And she'd go, yeah. And I said, well, I'll call back later. And then I'd call back later. I said, you're there? And she'd go, no. I said, well, tell him I called. And Becky was complicit in that. After Connie and I got married, I made Connie complicit in those things. You know, the phone, either don't answer the phone or answer the phone and tell a lie for me. And man, it was just brutal. It was brutal. And I can't explain why I couldn't do it. You know, I get to Alcoholics Anonymous because for the ill effects of my drinking. I had drinking alcohol-related problems that got me to AA. Those six DUIs are alcohol-related problems. I didn't think in terms of being alcoholic, but I knew I had alcohol-related problems. And that was not a mystery to me. Anything I did when I was drunk, I can explain. I was drunk. When I'm drunk, I do drunk stuff, right? Pour a fifth of whiskey in me and a fifth of whiskey in a non-alcoholic, we're both going to be drunk and we're going to do drunk stuff. But what I couldn't figure out was why on a Tuesday afternoon, with a middle-class life, with a pretty good job, with a wife that loved me and a kid that loved me, why do I feel the way that I feel? And if you'd said, well, how do you feel, Steve? I go, I don't know. But I know I don't feel like I think you feel. You know, there's a great line in the big book back in the Vision for You talking about Dr. Bob, and it said he was painfully aware of being somehow abnormal. For he did not yet fully understand what it meant to be alcoholic. And I was painfully aware of feeling somehow abnormal long before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it had nothing to do with my drinking. I knew that was abnormal too, but I didn't know there was a connection between the two. I didn't know I had alcoholism when I wasn't drinking. So I kept trying to solve an alcohol problem. I kept trying to not have alcohol-related problems. So I spent a lot of time trying to not let that happen again. Which is different than not drinking. I think our book calls it control and enjoy. I didn't have that kind of language. I just knew I did something I wish I hadn't done, and I'm going to try not to do that again. And I had no idea until I saw in our book where it says there'll come a time that the alcoholic won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'll be without defense against a drink. man, I get to AA, and you guys gave voice to my alcoholism. You gave me a language with which to talk about this alcoholism. You would say something, and the moment before it, I didn't know that was true. And the moment you said it, I know that's been true about me forever. I had no idea. I had no idea in 1980 when I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and I left a bar one afternoon, and I'd been drinking kamikazes and taking Tylenols, those 70s and 80s drugs, Sue. And I ended up going east in the westbound lane of the interstate. I hit a car head on, two other cars hit us. It totaled all four cars. It sent some people to the hospital, and it sent me to the Cobb County Jail. And I came to in that jail, and I'd urinated on myself, and I'd vomited on myself, or I hope I did, because somebody did. And so that's an indignity I prefer to have inflicted on myself. But in all honesty, that morning in that jail cell, in my own urine and my own vomit, I had never been more afraid of the consequences, legal, personal, and professional, that awaited me. I had never been so ashamed of the harm I'd caused other people. I didn't yet know the extent of the injuries, and again, two people were hospitalized, but it didn't turn out to be serious, certainly not life-threatening. I had never been more humiliated to be there in my own urine and my own vomit in that drunk tank on that Saturday morning. And I've never been more sure I'll never drink again. I'm done. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road, smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, and thinking, you know, I nearly stopped drinking. I nearly overreacted to that. Because I had no idea. Because it didn't feel like lack of power, right? It didn't feel like rebellion. I didn't understand about the strange mental blank spot that with alcoholism. I didn't understand that I could not bring to consciousness with sufficient force. I certainly remembered that I had had this wreck. I remembered I'd been arrested. I remembered I'd been in jail. But I couldn't feel what I felt that morning. And it made sense to me that I will do better. That firm resolve and good intentions should arm me to do better, but I don't understand the powerlessness of alcoholism. See, the one thing you guys did for me, or one of the many things you did for me, was once I get here, once I get to you, not wanting to be here, not understanding alcoholism, but deciding I probably need to not drink anymore. When I spent a little time in that treatment center, I decided I probably need to not drink. And I said, so I don't know, you know, so since I'm here and since they're taking us out to these AA meetings, I think AA is how I'm going to try to not drink. Now, I don't really understand what AA is going to ask of me. I already enjoyed your company. We went out to meetings, and you're fascinating people. I mean, not you people specifically, but as a group, you're fascinating. And it really was. I just fell in love with the stories and the people and with you talking about how I felt in a way that I had not been able to articulate. And again, you gave me this language. I mean, what a cool language we have in AA. You introduced me to the idea of the allergy, of the phenomenon of craving. You know, I was never at the bar, and after two or three drinks, nudged the guy next to me, and he said, I don't know about you, pal, but that phenomenon of craving's kicking in on me. Woo, lack of power is my dilemma. I got no language, but you guys were giving me some language, and I go, oh, I get it. And then when you began to talk about that those feelings, when I began to understand when it says the alcoholic knows loneliness as few do. See, I didn't understand until after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that loneliness, disconnection from you, frankly, once I move the bottle to the side, once I'm not taking a drink, this disconnection from you and a disconnection from God, which, by the way, for me are the same disconnection. That I'm lonely. And it wasn't for lack of people in my life. It wasn't for me not being social. I was a social guy. I was that guy, like I said. I was the actor. How does the big book describe me? It says the alcoholic, more than most, as an actor, he wears two faces. It's a stage character that he wants his fellows to see. He wants to be a man of certain reputation, but in his heart, he knows he doesn't deserve it. I spent so much time trying to somehow either win your approval or elicit whatever effect I thought I needed to elicit from you. And even when getting it, even when being affirmed, it fell empty because I knew you were responding to the act. You know, when our book says that the alcoholic has an inability to form a true partnership with another human being, in my case, I believe that that was true because how can I have a true partnership if I'm never bringing truly who I am to that relationship? Because we can't connect on this superficial level. And we can have a relationship, but it doesn't connect. That was the loneliness for me, was there just was no internal connection. I'm a guy that could go to a movie or listen to a song on the radio and be brought to tears. In real life, not affect me. That puzzled me. But I've talked to a number of people who had a similar experience. You know, I was sitting in a meeting. I was a few years sober, 3 or 4 years sober, and I had talked almost as long as I've spoken here tonight, and it was not a speaker meeting, but I had some stuff to say, and I got home. I called my sponsor, who had been in the meeting with me, and I said, "Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting tonight?" And he said, "Oh, Steve, you're still asking all the wrong questions. Because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous?" He said, "But the truth is, you don't care whether you were self-righteous or not. You're afraid they caught you. You're afraid they think you're self-righteous. You're not worried about the defect of character. You're worried about what the defect looks like on you." And he said, "Here's the news." He said, "Steve, you're not who you think you are. And you're not who they think you are. And you're especially not who you think they think you are." Now, I will tell you, that's revelatory to me. Because here's the good news. We've all been wrong about me. There's comfort in that. Really, because it means I can quit trying. That maybe I can just be me. And when we say that what other people think of us is none of our business, I don't confuse that, or don't you believe for a moment that I don't care what you think about me. I absolutely do. But what you tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous is to begin acting on principle that the actions I take should not be dictated by what I think you'll think about me. That my actions need to be dictated by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the conclusions you draw about me based on that are none of my business. Though I still tend to ask around. Yeah. "How do you think I'm doing?" And yeah. "I'll need some help after this talk, if you don't mind." Yeah. You know, when I was just a few months sober, I shared in a meeting one day, and somebody made the mistake of following me out to the parking lot and said, "Steve, I really enjoyed what you shared." For the next 6 months, I just hung out in the parking lot waiting for somebody to come by and tell me they, you know, because I need constant reassurance, you know. I'm leaving my house to go to a meeting one night and came downstairs. My daughter was there, and she said, "Dad, you going to wear that shirt?" I said, "Not now." Because, again, what I think you think, right? "Sweetheart, come pick something out for me, will you?" Because now, clearly, I don't know what to do. That's the... Once I get sober, once I quit drinking, I believe that self, you know, self is the enemy. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. And it's imperative for me to stop drinking to be able to get down, as the book says, to causes and conditions, to take a look at these underlying things and what I realize. And more, and it's just been a theme really for me for the last 10 or 12 years, is that continued freedom from the bondage of self, that continued freedom and opportunity to relax and be who I am, that's available to me, but it's still hit or miss. I am prone to falling into needing approval. on any given time. But I'm aware of it in a way I've never been, and often I just laugh at myself for being so needy. It's I recognize that I still have it, but I just go, you know, boom, there I go again. Their self showed up. I think that second half of the first step for me, see what I've discovered, and again, you know, our book says that each of us in our own language and from our own point of view talks about how he established a relationship with God. So when I'm talking from up here, I'm talking about, I love the idea of a point of view. And a point of view is just what it looks like from here. So when I share, I'm just telling you what it looks like from here. June asked me earlier tonight, she says, can you see the ocean from your room? And I said, you know, if I lean way over and look at, but there's some people in there who have an ocean view and some people who have a view of the parking lot. Now they're both seeing things correctly. They just have a different point of view. And so there's room for a variety of different points of view here. So from my point of view, when I got here, you guys introduced me to that relationship with alcohol that the alcoholic has, and it was true of me. That when I drink, I can't control the amount I take, and when I try to stop, I don't seem to be able to stay stopped. And both of those things became true of me. And those are exclusive to the alcoholic, right? That phenomenon of craving never, ever happens in the average temperate drinker. So that's exclusive to the alcoholic, that relationship to alcohol. But that second half of the first step, that unmanageability, that spiritual malady, that is there are over 200 other 12-step programs that have that in their first step. So that is common to the alcoholic, but perhaps not exclusive. So I've got those feelings, that unmanageability. You could just as easily for me in the second half of that first step say that I'm powerless over alcohol. Myself had become unmanageable. And that self for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is the pride and ego. That I am egocentric, and the 12 steps are moving me toward a God-centric life. I am self-centered, moving toward a God-centered life. I am self-reliant, moving toward a God-reliant life, which is much different than the believing in a higher power, but am I reliant? Do I take the actions a guy would take if he really believed? And that's the commitment I make in the third step. So when I get to AA and it looks like I need to stop drinking, and I decide to stop. I'm going to stop, and it looked like, and if there are some newer people here, I know Sue was asking. So what I was willing to do was not drink. But it felt like to me that we were going to spend a lot of time not drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought not drinking was an actual activity in AA. Yeah, we'll just get together and not drink. And you know, would you look at Doug not drink over there, man, and look at June. The technique on her is unbelievable. And somebody would call and say, Steve, man, we're going to go on a golf weekend, and we'd love you to go. I said, boys, I'd love to go, but I am busy this weekend. I will be home not drinking. And somebody said, don't drink even if your ass falls off. So I'll be home not drinking, guarding my ass. And I'm willing to do it. It's going to be a lot of self-sacrifice. Life's about to get real small. It's going to be all about where I can't go, what I can't do, who I can't hang out with, that this life in AA, this puritanical life that you're introducing me to, is just going to be just, it's not going to be fun, but I'm going to do it for the people around me. I'm tired of hurting people. And that's honestly what I thought. Now, I know, and I think the vast majority of you here know, because we are preaching to the choir here tonight, that, man, my life got bigger than it had ever been. I had to have some distance before I could see how small my life had become, where I did not and could not go back to the people, the relationships that had been severed, the disconnection from people. So you opened me up. And this opportunity to really be with one another. So I'm going to try to not drink. And you go, Steve, that's probably not going to work here in AA. I mean, you got a short shelf life on not drinking on your own power. Because it seems like the right thing to do. I'm going to come at it with all I got. You guys, and the third step redirects me. You told me, no, don't just surrender to the problem, surrender to the solution. You told me quit trying to not drink and start trying to connect with a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Now, sometimes I got to hold my breath and not drink that one day at a time early on. Can I get through the day? Because I really, I'm used to having a drink when I feel like this. I'm not used to feeling like this and not doing something about it. So can you hang on another day or two, Steve? But ultimately what I'm doing is not through self-will, not through good intentions, not to make my wife happy, not to be a better father, but ultimately you said if you will connect with a power greater than yourself, if you'll go through the process of these steps, which will remove those things that block you off from the sunlight of the Spirit, the problem will have been removed. When I get to the 10th step, the line that used to bother me a lot, it talks about, right, that position of neutrality, that, and it says that we won't be fighting it, the problem will have been removed, and it says this new attitude toward liquor will be given me with no thought or effort on my part. I mean, are you kidding me? I've been working my ass off in AA. I've been giving people rides I don't like. I've been cleaning up after people. I'm taking direction from a sponsor who's clearly confused. I've been working steps. That's the language you're using. So what do you mean, no thought or effort on my part? But see, then I realized that that thought or effort on my part hasn't been about acquiring a new attitude toward liquor. It's been trying to connect with this power greater than myself. And this new attitude toward liquor is a side effect. That's what happens. It is a psychic change. I haven't gotten any smarter in AA. My virtue is questionable. There's no more intelligence. Neither of those is necessary for recovery. Thank God. Just surrendering to the process. And I didn't get smarter. I changed. I haven't resisted a drink in a long time. Now, don't misunderstand me. I know I'm capable of taking a drink again. But I'm going to tell you, I'm not here tonight out of fear of taking a drink. I'm here tonight because I'm so blessed to have the life that I have. I'm here tonight because of what Sue said as she was talking about that paragraph back in A Vision for You, that substitute that is vastly more than a substitute for a drink. That substitute that says life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead, so we find the fellowship and so will you. The most satisfactory years of my existence have been since I've been sober, but the good news for me is I believe that the best is yet to come. And that is not about external things, it is about continuing to be freer so I can have the experience in this life, so I can be more comfortable, so I can be more useful. You know, when that In the book, when it talks about the story of Fred, right, and it says we heard no more Fred for a while, we all laugh at that line, but when Fred finally sobers up, and he sobered up early in that story about Fred, it said he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. And that didn't work, right? That's when we didn't. He went on about his business in that frame of mind, and things went south. He ended up back laid up. The AA guys come back and see him. They laid out that plan of action, and he says while it was entirely practical, it meant he would have to let go of several lifelong conceptions. And how it works, we say we got to let go of old ideas or the result is nil. Then it says, I made up my mind to go through with the process. And my drink problem, he never drank again. He said it felt that my drink problem was removed. And it says, while my old way of life was no way a bad one, my new way of life is infinitely more satisfying, and I believe useful than the one I left behind. Satisfying is a key word for me. See, I've been spending all my life trying to be self-satisfied, not knowing it. I don't know any of this while I'm doing it. I'm spiritually asleep, and you are waking me up. And when I get awake, I go, oh, I've been looking out here for everything. I've been trying to get the job, what is it that's going to make me okay? What's going to make me feel better? What's going to make me feel complete? And I keep trying to satisfy self, and self is insatiable. So really, I'm trying to connect to this power. You know, there's a wonderful story. It's a Sufi story, but with my accent, I don't feel right telling a Sufi story. So I've just made it a couple of Tennessee rednecks. And so there's an old boy who's lost the keys to his pickup truck. And he's out in his front yard looking for the keys. He's crawling around on his hands and his knees looking for these keys. And a couple of his buddies drive by and they see him out there and ask him what happened. He tells them he's lost the keys to his truck. And like good friends are wont to do, they get out and help him look. And they're crawling around. And pretty soon, a couple of more guys come by. Before you know it, you got 8 or 10 guys out there crawling around, painstakingly looking for the keys to his truck. Till finally, one of them asks, "Where were you when you lost the keys?" And he said, "Well, I was in the house." And they said, "What are we doing out here?" And he said, "Well, the light's so much better out here. See, I keep looking out here." And the key is inside. I keep thinking my problems are external. But they're not. We talk about it all the time. You know, acceptance is the answer, right? We talk about a day at a time. If I really mean a day at a time, because that first day at a time is, can you not drink today, Steve? Can you get from here to tomorrow's meeting? We'll see you here, man. We can't wait. Can you hold on and can you gut it out? And so at first we're not drinking a day at a time. But there comes a time when we want to live a day at a time. When I want to be able to embrace this day. And if I want to have a good day today, then I got to accept you just as you are and me just as I am today. This is a set of circumstances I've got. Now, there's a lot of things I want to change. I certainly want you guys to change. I got some notes for you later. But I don't want to wait on that to be okay. So I can be okay right now. God's ready the moment I am. But it requires a level of surrender that I'm not often willing or able to get. And God solves my problems in ways that I don't anticipate. See, if I'm wrong about the problem, that means I'm wrong about the solution most of the time, right? So one more story. There's a salesman that was a top performer in his company, well liked by everybody. He just had one seeming problem. Every week when he went in to give his sales report to the CEO of the company, he would wet himself. And after this happened twice, the CEO of the company was a kind, compassionate man, and he said, "We're going to connect you with the company psychiatrist to help with that problem." And the guy said, because he was just horribly embarrassed by this, as you would expect. And he came back the next week and went in to give his report, and sure enough, he urinated on himself. And the CEO said, "Well, I'm sorry you didn't get the chance to get in and see the psychiatrist." And he went, No, I saw her. "I'm sorry she couldn't help you with your problem." And he went, No, she solved my problem. And he said, "Dude, you just pissed yourself." He said, "Yeah, but I'm no longer embarrassed about it." What's the solution to my problem? What's the solution to my problem? You changing or me finding a way to be okay? I've got 1 minute. Catch me out in the hallway. I'd like to finish this talk later. You know, the two most often told lies from the podium by an alcoholic is, I'll be brief, and I'll end with this. So I got about a four-minute story that I'll end with, because once I got to AA, once I decided to stop drinking, once I decided AA is how I'm going to do it, I got kind of pumped up. I raised my hand. I pled guilty to the crime of alcoholism. I got it. What you guys been talking about, I got it. And then I read in the book and you shared that if you got it, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. And I thought, oh, damn, that's a problem. I got a problem I can't solve. I'm in a trap I can't spring, and you're offering me a solution I'm uninterested in and don't believe in. I'm going to those AA meetings the first few months I'm sober. We would circle up and say the Lord's Prayer, I think, and I would step away from the circle and not say the prayer. And by the way, people told me that was perfectly okay, and if someone else is doing that, it's perfectly okay. But a guy came over and asked me, he said, Steve, what's that about, man? Why are you doing that? And I was earnest, and I said, you know, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I'm not sure what I believe, and I'm not just going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya with the rest of the campers because that's what y'all are doing. Now, this guy had been my counselor in treatment, and he had heard my treatment fifth step, which was pretty much a confessional of whatever I could get out at the time. But he had heard that about that head-on collision. He had heard about six DUIs and six total automobiles. He had heard that I was drunk at the hospital when my daughter was born. He had heard that I stole time and money from the family business. He had heard about infidelities in my marriage. And he said, but hypocrisy, that's where you draw the line. And I said, that's really impressive, man. And he said, I got good news for you and bad news for you. And I felt condescended to. If you're new in AA and feel condescended to, it's because someone was just condescending. But I said, I'll play. What's the bad news? He said, the bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And you might ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. And I said, what's the good news? He said, the good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm more grateful for that tonight than I was then. But that allowed me to step in just a little bit, start holding hands, start saying a prayer. I didn't believe, but I think there was something about being a part of this rather than separating myself from it. And nobody required me to believe anything. They just asked me to go along. At about 8 years sober, and that worked for a good while, and I don't want to imply that my sobriety was and my emotional even sobriety was lacking, but at about 8 years sober, I'd never really been able to grab hold of a conception of a higher power that I could really get my arms around for me. And I'm grateful that our book says, you know, that there may be a wide variation in the way each of us approaches and conceives of that power, and that for our purpose, these differences need not matter. And the 12 and 12 says that there may be as many different spiritual experiences as people who have them. So that just gives, so none of us are wrong or right, right? Nobody has the whole story. I don't have to argue with you. I'm not taken back anymore if we see things differently. But at that time, I was still struggling. So I finally found ultimately what kind of works for me. And my point of view is I don't perceive of God doing anything to me or for me. I'm just trying to connect to this power. I don't know how it works. I just know that when I am connected, that my experience of life is different. When the book says that no one can fully define or comprehend that power, that's comforting to me. When it says in the last analysis, it is that you know, deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I've decided for me, that's the point of view I take. And it says that as I draw near to him, he will disclose himself to me. And if I believe God is deep within every man, woman, and child, the way I draw near to him is to draw near to you. When you folks invite me here tonight and let me speak for 54 minutes, going on 55, and pretend to listen, this power shows up in a way that I can't define or comprehend. There was a guy in Nashville when I got sober, a guy named Mo, old-timer named Mo H. And Mo was that guy, and you've got him in your home group, and some of you folks are that person for somebody else. But you know when you were new and you were going to meetings and you didn't even know people yet, but you hoped he or her would be at the meeting that next week, you were there, and just there was that always one or two people that, man, I just hope that they're there, because when they're there, it just makes me feel like everything's going to be okay. Just makes me feel like it's going to be okay. And Mo was one of those guys for me. And whenever Mo talked, he ended his talks with a little poem. And the poem is by William Blake, and Mo misquotes it. But I've been misquoting it myself because I give the Mo version. When Mo came down with cancer in 2003, my friend Jerry and I went to breakfast with him, and we knew that is probably our last time to be together. And he passed away 6 weeks later. But that morning at breakfast, I asked Mo, I said, would you mind if when I get a chance to share my story, I close with that poem that you've always used? I said, because it describes my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, in the truest sense of AA, it will help me pass on what you have given to me and so many others. And he said, oh, Steve, he said, if you think it'll help another drunk. And I will tell you, from October of 2003 until tonight, I've never told a version of this story that I didn't end with that poem. And it's always helped another drunk, because I'm the drunk, it always helps. He said, I sought my God, I could not see. And I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. When I strip everything else away from me, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has been. That when we get together like this, this power shows up in a way that I can't define or comprehend. It has made it unnecessary for me to take a drink since June the 29th of 1989. But most of the time when I'm willing to accept the gift, it has provided me a life that's happily and usefully whole. And for that, I'm awfully grateful, and I thank you for the chance to be here with you tonight.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12stepTapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.